Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest, Deacon Harold Berg Sivers, is the co-host of EWTN's Morning Glory. He's a Catholic speaker and evangelist, founder and director of DynamicDeacon.com, author of Behold the Man, A Catholic Vision of Male Spirituality, and The Mass in Sacred Scripture. You can visit him at DeaconHarold.com. He's also spent many years in public service in various types of law enforcement and public safety. Deacon, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Always great to be with you, Al. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I've spent a lot of time in Detroit and spent a lot of time with black pastors during the years I was an evangelical pastor. And race was a regular topic of conversation in Detroit. When I moved to Ann Arbor, it was not very much on people's minds or agenda. Location has a lot to do with how you see this topic. Social experience, your background, your own race has a lot to do with how you see the topic. You're black, I'm white. Do you understand race differently and in a way that I would have a very difficult time accessing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Al. I think what it comes down to, I think you're exactly right. It comes down to your experience, and I think we have to be clear, you know, what we mean by racism or prejudice. So prejudice is like a preconceived opinion that's not based on reason or actual experience. So, for example, Al, when people, in fact, this happened to me earlier this year, when I was at a speaking engagement and someone found I went to Notre Dame for my undergrad. And I said, oh, you went to Notre Dame. What position did you play? Now, see, the question that should have been asked, Al, was, what did you study? You see, because I never played football. I never played football. So in fact, my high school didn't even have football. So is that kind of stuff is prejudice. Again, not saying that is a racist statement, but it's definitely prejudice because it's not based on any reason. Now, racism comes in when you have a prejudice with the added element of believing that your race is superior to another person's race. So it may be a prejudiced opinion, but that opinion is based on the fact that my race is superior to your race. So racism includes prejudice and discrimination and those kinds of things. So I think my experience would be different, because sometimes I think people see me differently. I remember in Chicago, I was speaking at an event, 5,000 young people, and I was dressed in a suit and a tie with a deacon pin and my crucifix on and everything. I walk into an elevator. There was only one other a smaller kind of white lady, very, very nice. I walked in and I acknowledged and said hello, smiled, and she just she moved to the back of the elevator and clutched her purse. And I was like, oh,
oh, that's
boy,
terrible.
Okay. I mean, so obviously, now, of course, I mean, she may have been assaulted in the past, and she, you know, is having a flashback or something. But I didn't do it, though. I didn't do it. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
And I didn't say anything. I just turned around, faced the elevator, didn't say anything to her. I knew she was scared. See, so that happens to you, being pulled over, driving while black, and things like that.
Right.
So those kinds of things, I think, affect your experience. And because I think many white people may not experience at the same level. That's why they may not be able to understand the experience of those of us who have.
Sure. It's not uncommon for minorities to always be more aware of what constitutes them as a minority over against the majority. I mean, I've often said that white people, generally speaking, don't talk a lot about race. It doesn't occur to them that it's an issue. They don't define, they don't think of them, because they're the majority. They don't define themselves by their race. They define themselves by, you know, maybe interest or education level or where they work. But they don't, whiteness never becomes a conscious part or rarely becomes a conscious part. In fact, a white person who thinks a lot about white race is often thought to be, you know, moving in the direction of alt-right or the Klan.
Yeah, that. Yeah, I see where you're coming from, Al. And, you know, my experience has always been I've grown up around white people often. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey in Hillside, right next to Newark, and I went to a parish that was predominantly white. I was in a Boy Scout troop that had very mixed race. I went to a high school that was predominantly black, run by white Benedictine monks. Some of my greatest male influences were like my wrestling coach, you know, Michael DiPiano Sr., and you know, the monks at the Abbey, Father Edwin Leahy, and those guys at St. Ben. I mean, these guys greatly influenced. They believed in me,
right?
Even when I didn't believe in myself. And so I learned through my experience. When I see somebody, I don't think white, black, Hispanic. I just see a person,
right?
You know?
Right.
But it's often a person who is not a person of color who sometimes reminds me that I'm black when I'm interacting with them. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
I'm with you, Al, I don't think, I mean, when we're together,
right,
we just talk right about what's going on in the world. We don't even right think about color. And that's the way it should be. But sometimes people, you know, when you're engaged, will remind you, oh, you're black or something like that.
Right,
know?
Right. So. Well, back in Detroit, we'd have pastors, suburban pastors and urban pastors getting together, trying to, you know, build bridges. And it was always interesting because when, in fact, the topic of race would come up, if there was only one black person in the room, everybody looks to him as though somehow he's the one who's the authority on race, you know? This is one of those things that I think... It's in some ways it's amusing, but I think it's because, again, race is not a very common topic when white people get together. Let me ask you if the Catholic Church has a very good recent history in the area of fighting institutional racism.
Well, I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, we have to understand what we mean by institutional racism.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So, when I think about that, I think in order to factually claim that an institution is racist, you have to show that the institution actively promotes racism,
right,
either through official or unofficial mm-hmm policies or directives,
right,
and that enshrine the belief that one race is superior than another. So I think institutional racism, for example, Jim Crow laws,
right,
the Dred Scott versus John F. Sanford Supreme Court decision, those things were institutionalized because they were written into the law, and that was part of the fabric of the culture. So that's apartheid in South Africa, definitely institutional racism.
Right.
And so you'd have to look for institutions as opposed to institutions that have people that are racist in them.
Right.
Right.
Sure.
So the church itself is not racist. Why? It was founded by Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
There are individuals in the church, clergy and laity, who are racist or who don't appreciate race or the gift of racist of the race. So for example, Al, I written an article for Catholic World Report, and in there I said one of the things that Catholics can do is, especially if they have a parish that has some cultural diversity, is to appreciate the gifts that the other cultures bring,
right,
and somehow incorporate that into the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I meant by that, of course, was singing or clothing or something, nothing that violates any of the rubrics of the Mass.
Right, right.
You know, like dance or something like that that doesn't belong in the Mass at all. But when I made that statement, people said, "Oh, you're trying to incorporate all this crazy stuff in the Mass." Like, what? What are you talking about? See, so people already have these preconceived notions and conceptions, and I think they bring those attitudes with them even into the church. So, for example, Al, let me give you this. My father had a massive conversion experience because it started with EWTN, and this man was not baptized, never went to church, never really talked about God or anything like that. But after that experience, he went and his experience going to the church for the Catholic Church for the first time here in Oregon, when he came to visit my family for the first time. When he went back home to New Jersey, he just went into a Catholic church. He thought he would receive the same reception there that he received when he was out here. And he walked into the church, and no one greeted him. No one came up to him. No one said anything to him.
Wow.
So he goes, wait a minute, what is this? Because he thought all Catholic churches were like that. So I think we need to be very mindful of being aware that we are, as individuals, representing Christ himself in our Catholic communities, in our churches.
You know, it's been pointed out time and again that the classic leaders of the modern civil rights movement from the 50s into the early 60s especially were Christian pastors who did try to integrate Christian faith into their political activism. Does that still happen today among Black activists, or has it become more secularized?
Well, I think the problem is that sometimes we have as Black folks, we have a problem separating our politics from our faith.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. Because, for example, I see myself, if somebody said, oh, what are you? I said, I'm Catholic. I wouldn't say I'm a Black Catholic. I'm a Catholic who happens to be Black.
Right.
And I say that not to diminish the gift of my Black heritage.
Sure.
And I say that instead of African American, Al, because I was born in Barbados in the West Indies, so I'm not technically African American.
Very different
Caribbean
experience. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't say that to diminish the gift of my Blackness, which I thank God every day that I'm Black. That's not the question. The question is when I stand before Almighty God, He's going to ask me, did you follow my Son? Did you take up your cross and follow him every day? Did you feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, clothe the naked? Did you love God and your neighbor as yourself? That's what he's going to ask. He's not going to ask me how Black I am. So my faith has to come first before anything else. Now, because I am Black, there are gifts. And I see this so beautiful example in the Maronite church and the other church, where they bring their cultural gifts to bear in a beautiful way.
Hold it there, Deacon. We'll come back and pick it up from there, and that is gifts that can be brought forth. I also want to ask you about law enforcement, because that's been a big part of this recent discussion because of the deaths that we've been seeing. So stay with me. We'll be right back. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Deacon Harold Brooks Sivers. We are talking about race in America, and his article in Catholic World Report, which is it's called The Catholic Response to Racism, very worthwhile. June 29th is the date on it. He has a number of recommendations there for, and by the way, the U.S. bishops have written on race. Those documents may be unfamiliar to many of us, but they are there. Be good to get familiar with them. One of the recommendations that he has, though, is that we need to get past stereotypes and see people as they are, which we talked about last segment. And we also talked about appreciating the gift of cultural diversity. Let's pick it up. That's where we closed the last segment. What does that actually involve, Deacon?
Well, it's very simple, Al. For example, I've been to many, many beautiful churches all throughout this amazing country that we live in, and some of them don't have much cultural diversity. Okay, which is okay, but you know, but they could, for example, have some statues or some pictures or some stained glass windows that reflect the wonderful diversity of the church. So of St. Martin de Porres,
yes,
for example. Mm-hmm. Moses the Black, or even Venerable Augustus Tolton, or others like that, you know, that just can show the people there that, hey, wait a minute, the church is not just me showing up with all of my people that live in my neighborhood, you know, worshiping
right.
together.
Right.
They're just so much richer. For example, if there's a parish down the street that has a wonderful diversity, invite them over to the parish. have like a parish cultural experience. Have everybody bring food. You know, some bring some Italian food, some Irish food, and maybe some of the other folks bring some Vietnamese food or some food from Mexico or from, you know, different parts of Africa, and just have this cultural experience and have people get up there and just talk and tell their stories. Yeah. I'm an immigrant to this country. Here's why I came here. Here's mm-hmm. some of the struggles I've had. Here's some of the things I'm facing even in the church. And so people are like, wait a minute, I didn't realize that this was going on. Just like you said, they don't realize that there were documents written since the 1950s that churches addressed race, but we're not familiar with them. So this is about really getting to know people around a shared cultural experience where you're really getting to know people, not just ideas and concepts about people.
This is so important because it's not just a matter of being a good neighbor, it's also a matter of being a good witness. This is one way that we bear witness to the coming kingdom, in which there's many nations, tribes, and tongues, and it's a very, look at a World Youth Day, and you'll get some idea of how diverse the kingdom of God is going to be. And so it's good to start practicing now. You spent 23 years in various types of law enforcement and public safety. The death of George Floyd and a host of others over the last few years has really sparked reaction. Looking at Ahmaud Arbery, you know, the murder, Dylann Roof's murder of, I think it was 8 people in Charleston. And, I mean, you come up with these lists, and we've got video on so many of these instances. So, you're very familiar with the world of law enforcement. What do you say to people who claim that these instances show systemic, these are systemic acts of white supremacy on the part of these officers?
Well, again, you'd have to show that the police themselves practice systemic racism, which I don't think is the case at all.
Right.
I think just like the church, the church is not racist, but there are people in it that are racist. I think the same thing could be said for the police, because the police don't have policies where you're putting your knee on people's necks. And I was horrified, not only by the death of Mr. Floyd, but by the other incidents as well.
Yeah.
And no one is more angry about what's been going on than good cops.
Right.
Just like good priests are angry about those few priests who are abusing children.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that the police organizations themselves are that systemic racism, but I think there are certain officers that do that are racist, and that's the problem.
Do you what do you have some idea of how rigorous, how much time is spent in training police officers about the use, the appropriate use of force? Is that a major issue?
There is a lot of time spent on use of force, and it's a continuum. It's a use of force continuum. So it goes all the way from verbal de-escalation, and it works its way up from there all the way to the use of deadly force. And so, yeah, quite a bit of time is spent. And in fact, scenario training is a lot of time spent on scenario-based training to give the officers the feel and the sense of being in that situation and learning how to make a decision and act. The problem is, I think, Al, is that some of these officers bring in biases and prejudices into that. So when they learn how to deal with things in these scenarios, they're also bringing in some of these other prejudices and things that they've had before they even entered into the academy.
Yeah.
And I think what we need to, I think there needs to be reform and rebuilding, absolutely. This whole idea of defunding is ridiculous.
Yeah.
We can definitely spend more time training these officers on issues of race and identifying and acknowledging their own prejudices and biases, and understanding that, like, for example, the Police Executive Research Forum has recommended that the officers receive training in just recognizing the dignity of the human person. So this is a great place for people of faith to step in and say, here's one area that we can really help these officers break down these biases and stereotypes to help them become better servants of the community.
You know, I wonder when you hear that phrase, defunding the police, what does that stand for? I mean, I saw a headline that $1 billion has been taken out of the New York City police budget. You have to ask yourself, what are they not spending money on now? Is that just one of those, you know, phrases that people throw around to signal that they think reform is necessary? Or does defund the police actually mean a certain type of budget cut?
Yeah, I think there's two ways of thinking about it. You can think of defunding police as Minneapolis did, which is disbanding the police and coming up with a different public safety model. Or it could be like New York or other places who have reallocated funds from law enforcement and put those in other places because they think those other folks can respond to situations better than police, like with dealing with people with mental health or homeless issues and things like that.
Yeah.
But when you cut the police, what exactly are you cutting?
Right.
What are you going to cut? Are you going to cut homicides? You going to cut sex trafficking? You're going to cut identity theft? You're going to cut drugs and gang policing? I mean, policing is a vocation from God. You know, greater love has no man, Jesus said, and lay down his life for his friends. So the police officers who are excellent and work hard every day to protect and serve and give their lives for strangers if necessary, that's what they're committed to. And so, you know, like, and I mentioned this in the article, Al, if there was a serial arsonist killing dozens of people, and if this is later discovered that these arsonists are firefighters, no one would ever think to defund the fire department because of the actions of a few rogue firemen.
Right.
You know, no one is calling for defunding of physicians because some doctors perform abortions or euthanize their patients.
Right.
And police are not trained to kneel on people's necks. They're not trained to shoot people in the back.
Yes.
So I think one of the things that people can do is go on a ride along. Every agency that I know of allows for citizens, privacy, to go on a ride-along with the officers, see what these people do on a daily basis, then make an informed decision on how to move forward. Everyone's reacting out of anger and vitriol and without understanding day-to-day what these officers do and what they have to deal with. Get in the car, ride with them, see their experience, and then talk about how to move forward.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a great idea. I think that's a great idea. Familiarity and acquaintance overcomes a lot of prejudices and silly ideas. In your experience with law enforcement, are they any more, or police officers, public safety officials, any more or less committed to Christ, the gospel?
Yeah, I think there's a huge void in there. I mean, you have a lot of officers that have problems in their own families. The divorce rate is high. The alcohol rate is consumption rate is high. Divorces, suicides, you know, because they deal with the worst of the worst in society.
Yep. Yep.
And I don't think there's enough men of faith or women of faith that are working in these types of jobs. I think they can really, I mean, if they bring their faith to bear and their training, because they want to make sure they go home to their own families at night, I think it can make a huge difference in how we look at this. And I think this is something, again, that the Police Executive Research Forum is calling for when it talks about helping officers to recognize the inherent dignity of every human person. This is something that a person of faith already brings to the table.
Right.
By the very nature of who they are. So I think people of faith would bring great gifts and I think would really help in the training, in scenario-based training, and in developing skill sets for officers to deal with people, again, as human beings made in the image and likeness of God.
You know, I agree with you. One of the things that troubles me is I don't hear, and I don't see a lot of priests or Protestant pastors participating in building bridges between police and their communities. I mean, some of those men and women who have special skills in this area are not getting much attention. And I don't know if that's a result of the mainstream press or if they're just being neglected. Do you have any idea?
Well, I think it's selective, Al. There are, for example, priests that are police chaplains.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I go to a parish, there'll be a priest who is a chaplain. In his homily, he'll talk about an experience he had. Or some dioceses have blue masses, where they have masses for police officers. Like they have the red mass for the attorneys. You know, they have a blue
That's right.
mass for police officers and things like that. So I think it's very selective and few and far between. But I don't think there's an active movement to really build bridges, as you said, Al. And that's what we need to do, mm-hmm. to really build bridges of understanding, so that people can understand here is why the officer is taking the action that they're taking. And so the officer can see, wait a minute, but I'm also dealing with a person here. You know,
yep.
For example, I remember once we were dealing with a guy who was had some mental issues. Mm-hmm. And rather, you know, my officers were ready. I said, no, let me talk to the guy. So I talked to the guy and, you know, I thought I was getting him calmed down. And all of a sudden, without warning, he just lunged at me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, man, this was going so well. But I had to take him to the ground. And as we were cuffing, I was saying, you're okay. You're going to be all right. You know, just again, the humanness of that
right.
interaction, you know.
Yeah. Deacon, what should people read of church documents in this area?
Well, just Google the fact. I would start with the latest USCCB document on racism that released it in 2019. Great place to start.
All right. Deacon, great talking with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great to be with you, Al. Thank you for having me.
Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers will have more follow-up information.